The AC-130, the 105 gunners ejected the spent brass casing as soon as the recoil had finished and had the next 33-pound round in the breech in less than 5 seconds. As soon as they called, "Gun ready!" Turner hit it again. This was the type of mission gunship crews lived for, killing bad guys when their brothers-in-arms were in dire straits, knowing full well no other fixed-wing aircraft was as decisive an edge. Footnote. D.J. Turner's crew would play a critical role in the coming hours and days. For Haas's men and the ATF, they would be involved in a friendly fire incident less than an hour after striking the Dishka. But as events developed on Taker Gar 48 hours later, it was Turner who would find himself over the mountain when the battle there unfolded. The pilots and sensor operators watched with satisfaction as the rounds killed the two machine gunners instantly. Having been pre-cleared by Andy for the rest of the target, they trained their weapons on the tent, shredding it with multiple 105 rounds and strewing the contents across the rock face. As the members of Mako 3-1 collected their rucks, Grim 3-1 fired on yet another flanker, killing him outright. They waited till the gunship finished its work, then moved carefully back to the Dishka position to conduct a battle damage assessment, certain in their movement thanks to the watchful eyes overhead. At the Dishka and tent, they found 5 bodies cooling in the early morning air. Inside the tent was a treasure trove of Cyrillic documents confirming the fighter's Chechen ethnicity, as well as a few Arabic papers. The most significant find came from inspecting the Dishka. It was clean and serviceable, freshly oiled, with 2,000 rounds stacked conveniently around it. Goody reported, "The AQ had built a makeshift traverse and elevation mechanism allowing it to hit targets out to 3,000 meters and to easily cover the flight routes of the U.S. helicopters which would arrive shortly. The position also had an RPG launcher with 7 rounds, a Russian Dragunov 7.62mm sniper rifle, multiple AK-47s, and the PKM machine gun that the Chechens had used in their attempt to flank the team. Mako 3-1 occupied their adversary's former position, making it their new OP, and planned to remain for the duration of the operation. When TF Rakasan flew into the valley 50 minutes later, the SEAL team leader tracked their approach through the Dishka's gun sights. Chapter 15. March 2nd. Nighttime. Throughout the valley, Grim 3-1's explosive display announced the Americans' presence like a bullhorn in church, eliminating the need for further verification by the enemy. Both sides knew it was on, and that realization had the fortuitous consequence of unsettling many of the Al-Qaeda fighters. On the whale, many took to firing their weapons blindly into the darkened sky, exposing them to the watchful eyes of J-Team, who, like everyone else, had observed the display to their south. Jay listened in on the same fires freak as Andy used to kill off the Dishka element. Footnote. Every combat controller used the same fires frequency for strikes in the Shahikat. Not only did this allow for sequencing and handoffs, it crucially prevented fratricide. Despite the coming battles and dozens of danger-close airstrikes conducted by CCT during Anaconda, not one instance of friendly fire took place under their control. As fast as he could, Jay, using the entire team to help with distances and coordinates, began logging previously unknown positions for later strikes. They counted down the minutes until their own first strike, when the B-1 with the 2,000-pound thermobaric bomb arrived at H-30. Sitting in the OP with his radios arrayed around him, but primarily concerned only with his M-biter on the fires freak, Jay watched and waited for the B-1. As soon as it made contact, known as checking in, he would verify the 9-line brief to ensure ground and air were synchronized. Footnote. The 9-line brief is used by all U.S., NATO, and Allied fighters and bombers to receive information from the individual controlling the strike or bomb drop on the ground. It is conducted upon first contact, usually over a predetermined geographic point, known as the initial point, but referred to as IP. Jay was ready. As soon as the bomber dropped the thermobaric and destroyed the closest threat, he hoped to move him to the whale to drop a handful of 1,000-pound J-dams. These were bombs that had been converted from dumb bombs, unguided except by gravity, to all-weather smart bombs. A bolt-on fin kit allowed the ordnance to be steered to a target by inertial guidance and GPS or laser energy. Jay gazed out across the valley in the early morning twilight, his NVGs stored back in the ruck and a wool hat inadequately keeping the cold at bay. To the west, he was beginning to make out terrain features on the whale, where the fighting positions they'd mapped in the dark were taking shape, when an explosion behind him rocked the entire OP, shaking the earth beneath them. The Al-Qaeda cave had blown up. Wide-eyed shock and disbelief were exchanged wordlessly on the OP. A mushroom cloud of coal-black smoke enveloped a fireball where the cave entrance sat an instant before, the sound still reverberating across the early morning calm. The B-1 had dropped without checking. J-Team, less than 700 meters from the target, was just beyond the danger-close distance of 500 meters for a 2,000-pounder, but the men were pissed. This was just the kind of miscommunication that could get them killed in the coming hours and days. Suppose they'd move closer to recon activity. Or worse, the GPS coordinates were off. With no nine line, it was a bit of Russian roulette, with dozens of aircraft barrels pointed at the AFO teams. According to Chris, the initial strikes comprised the following. 8 J-dams were dropped on the whale, and only 1 J-dam on Taker Gar. The AC-130 also fired at the bunker on the whale, and that was pretty much it for the great fire support plan. The whale should have been carpet-bombed based on the disposition of the enemy forces. Taker Gar should have been bombed more as well. Once again, AFO intel had previously identified enemy positions on Taker Gar. This would come back to haunt the U.S. forces soon after. With the reverberations of the explosion still echoing across the mountains, everyone in the valley, Al-Qaeda, AFO, and any remaining civilians, was well aware that a battle, whose shape had yet to fully develop, had commenced. At 06:30, three CH-47s swept into the northern end of the valley below J-Team, the thump, thump, thump of their heavy rotors echoing off the mountain slopes. Inside each were 40 combat troops from the Army's 101st Airborne Division. The Infantrymen's Battalion Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Chip Praisler, who was responsible for all of them and for the northern portion of the operation, was crammed near the front of the cargo compartment in one of the helicopters. Inside the helo, a door gunner called out a warning. 2 minutes! One of the senior infantry NCOs shouted the first order for the young soldiers inside. Lock and load! Simultaneously, 40-plus sounds of M4s, SAWs, and M240 machine guns chambering rounds could be heard over the din of rotor and engine noise, various clack-clacks on the machine guns and chick-clunks of the M4s. 30 seconds, came shortly after. The soldiers fingered their weapons nervously, almost none of them having seen combat, and many having no real idea of what to expect. At 06:33, Praisler's helicopter touched down. As it settled and the landing gear absorbed the load, the men shouldered their rucksacks and stood as one mass. Led by a 240 gunner, they charged down the helicopter's ramp, moving to the sounds of comrades shouting, "Go! Go! Move! Move!" They ducked under the low roof at the hinge and stepped into the Shahi cot. Straight into enemy fire. To the south, a similar scene was unfolding, only this time it was 120 men from the 10th Mountain Division. Lieutenant Colonel Paul LaCamera was in charge of the southern blocking positions, the Anvil. Colonel Frank Wersinski, commander of the 3rd Brigade, the Rakasans, from which T.F. Rakasan drew its name, was in charge of all the Allied forces in the valley. The two-battalion movement, essentially a brigade-size air assault, had happened only one other time since Vietnam, Wyszynski was aware of the lives under his command and of the history that would be made on this day, one way or another. As the blocking forces were inserting to the north and south, he orbited inside the rear of a flight of two Black Hawk helicopters, looking for a place to insert his tactical command team, known as the TAC. He planned to land near a geographic feature called the Finger, which lay at the base of Mako 3-1's new OP, remain on the ground only long enough to determine the operation's progress, and then fly back to Bagram. His chief task today was to assist his boss, Hagenbeck, with managing expectations at CENTCOM and in Washington, D.C., where President George W. Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld remained intimately connected to the campaign. Spotting a tactically desirable cleft in the rocky terrain, he keyed the microphone on his headset. "Put us down there," he told the pilots. The space was tight, and Wyszynski's pilot missed his approach, forcing the helo to go around and line up a second time. The second Black Hawk managed to squeeze in, missing the rock ledge with its rotor by 2 feet, dumping the TAC's security and radio team. As Wyszynski's helo circled back and lowered into the draw, an Al-Qaeda fighter stepped from a rock outcropping with an RPG and leveled it at the slow-moving Black Hawk. He squeezed the trigger, and the grenade punched out of the launch tube, streaking up toward the exposed underbelly of the helicopter, scoring a direct hit against the chin bubble. A second fighter, wielding an AK-47, took aim at the winged duck and unleashed an entire banana clip. His aim was good as he perforated the length of the helo's tail boom, damaging the tail rotor hub and nicking a push-pull rod inside that is critical to countering the main rotor's torque. If that thing had severed, we'd have lost tail rotor control, and we'd have been gone, recalled Jim Marier, the air mission commander on board. The TAC was taking fire even before Wyszynski's team touched the ground, but he'd chosen the site well, and it was masked from the enemy. Bullets were striking against the rocks above the soldiers as the two Black Hawks limped off in the morning light. They appeared to be safe from direct fire, for the moment. As they established Operation Anaconda's battlefield command and control position, the same could not be said for the 10th Mountain and 101st Airborne troops moving off their LZs. Even before the tail rotor strike, Wyszynski was listening to radio calls from the blocking positions regarding casualties and fierce enemy resistance. T.F. Rakasan was learning what Blaber and the men of AFO had already suspected. The enemy was well-armed, well-positioned, and hungering for a fight. There were no fleeing jihadis, and there was no organized retreat. Al-Qaeda was here to fight. As the TAC got their bearings and established a more secure perimeter, they were surprised to look up and find a corpse hanging off the ridge above them. Without knowing it, they were staring straight up at Mako 3-1 and the aftermath of their firefight, including the bodies of the enemy. By this time, the second wave of heavy-lift CH-47s was landing with more infantry, but the TF Hammer, General Hagenbach's main thrust forces, had stalled. Grim 3-1 had moved over their convoy and, in a tragic incident, had fired on them in the confusion, killing one American Green Beret and several ATF. Because of the attack and lack of concerted bombing of enemy positions, TF Hammer had retreated under the demands of a frustrated and angry Afghan commander Zia, leaving the U.S. infantry to carry on the fight alone. TF Hammer also stranded Blaber, who was attempting to get into the mountains to better track the battle and assist his teams in the field. Soon after the rest of TF Rakasan had inserted, the infantry had secured all the blocking positions except one, identified in the battle plan as Ginger. Ginger sat just below Taker Gar Mountain and was fiercely defended by a concentration of Al-Qaeda troops. With the mountains and high ground surrounding the Rakasan troops and the enemy refusing to flee, the infantry began its assault against the enemy positions, firing down on them. The majority of fire originated from the whale, but also seemed to be coming from the mountains to the north and east. Things turned deadly for Mako 3-1 when they began to receive direct fire. Not from Al-Qaeda, but from the Rakasans. Even though Andy had placed several VS-17 panels around their position when the fighting started. Roughly 2 foot by 6 foot, VS-17s were tough but pliable panels with parachute cord tie-downs along the edges and at each corner. They were orange on one side and vibrant cerise on the other, and were used for marking virtually anything on the battlefield as friendly. As the team took cover, Andy manned the radio and found the TAX Freak and call sign, diverting the friendly fire to a more prominent ridgeline east of the team. Soon after, hostile 82mm mortar rounds began to drop onto their position from a ridge just south of Taker Gar. The first rounds landed short, but the team couldn't see the enemy tube. When the next rounds landed long, the team was effectively bracketed. Incoming enemy or friendly fire could be managed, but not both. Goody made the decision to leave their OP. With all this shit that was going on, there was only one place to relocate, the Rakasan TAC. It was a surprise to the conventional army troops when Mako 3-1 walked into their beleaguered position. They too were taking more and accurate fire as the morning progressed, and introduced themselves simply as recon and surveillance snipers. Andy and Goody briefed Colonel Worsinski, and then Andy joined forces with the TAC Air Liaison Officer, an Air Force F-16 pilot assigned to assist with air support, while the other snipers beefed up the perimeter. In the north, Jay watched as the 101st was taking casualties. They were also returning the favor, pumping out 82mm and 120mm mortar rounds and engaging in pitched gunfights and mortar duels with enemy positions on the whale. Chris continues their observations. Because the AQ had been tipped off about the attack 24 hours prior, they were now waiting for the ATF to come into their AO, area of operations. The AQ knew exactly which way the ATF assault force was coming in because they were set up east to west, facing south, and online waiting in shooting positions. We saw them from our OP, and they were dressed in military kit. LBE, load-bearing equipment, small rucks, weapons, and even a guidon, a symbolic flag carried by soldiers since the Roman legions and used to identify units and inspire troops. Dave was on the scope and watched the AQ occupy positions as their commander used hand and arm signals to stage them. Once in position, the commander motioned the guidon bearer to move to him and then directed him to move to a building in the town of Serkenkel. We had observation of the 101st troops, and they were moving right toward the AQ. Jay called a B-52 in with JDAMs to strike the AQ positions, and within minutes, he dropped them right on top of the AQ, killing several to include the commander. The 101st called us and asked who gave us permission to drop the JDAMs because they were about 1 kilometer away. We explained the situation, and they understood, but told them we needed to make another pass. After the first pass, two guys got up and dragged the commander's body down into some low ground. In this low ground, more AQ were moving in and out. The 101st wanted to get farther out of the way, but instead moved directly toward where we were going to drop the next set of bombs. After the confusion of getting them moving in the right direction, Jay dropped right where the AQ were last seen and saw no movement from that area for about 2 hours. Then, the AQ reoccupied the same positions again, and Jay dropped the JDAMs on them once more. After the third JDAM strike that day, they reoccupied the position and had JDAMs dropped on them, and they never came back to it again. It appeared that they had a bunker or command post of some type in the low ground because the AQ would come out of this area after each strike and drag off the dead. Even the survivors of the bombings, who must have been wounded, would always assist in dragging the dead away. Jay was in his element as a combat controller, and, by every measure, was enjoying the most significant day of his career. Footnote. The guidon fielding commander observed by J-Team would turn out to be none other than Malawi Saif Araman Nasrallah Mansour, who had refused to consider his subordinate's request for reinforcements. At the TAC, Andy was alternating between airstrikes in conjunction with Major Dino Murray, the Air Liaison Officer, referred to by the acronym ALO, and the action taking place around their position. Chris, the SEAL sniper, had spotted an advancing force of 10 to 12 fighters. They moved every few minutes from position to position, each time pausing just long enough to take a few shots at us, several with RPGs, and a few who appeared to be leaders with handheld radios waving their arms and motioning still others over the ridgeline to come join the fight. The SEALs discussed the situation and, along with Andy, formed a line and moved forward, closing the distance with the enemy. An airstrike was out of the question, too close. Chris and Eric opened fire, killing several of the Al-Qaeda countersnipers outright. Andy and Goody crouched down and ran along a rock wall that masked their movement. Andy was also a trained sniper, a certification controllers could pursue in the course of their career if they desired. The two snipers popped up and rapidly engaged one target after another, killing half the enemy force. Recalls the controller, "The engagement was a one-sided affair." Four men eliminated the direct fire threat that had pinned down the Rakasan soldiers, killing 11 AQ and wounding another five. They then moved back to the ridgeline, providing overwatch for the conventional forces, while Andy Martin began calling in CAS and AH-64s on the enemy mortar positions detected by SEAL snipers, according to one AFO after-action report. The engagement didn't end there. Andy continued to wield B-52s and B-1s as the Rakasan and Al-Qaeda mortar teams traded salvos. The TAC was also being targeted during the exchanges, with the enemy effectively walking mortar rounds to within 50 meters of the beleaguered position. Several kilometers farther south, Hotaling and his SAS team were watching events unfold through sniper and spotting scopes, the details relayed through the combat controller's radio as his CCT brother destroyed enemy positions and fighters by the score. Unfortunately, at the far southern end of the valley, no engagements or fleeing enemy forces presented themselves. The SAS had labored and pressed their American ally hard for inclusion, so watching the action from the bleachers as the day wore on and hearing the friendly casualty count mount was simply not acceptable. As they talked it over, Matt, the team leader, was adamant. They needed to reposition closer to the action. The team pored over their maps and Hotaling's Falcon View, identifying a new OP to the north that was close enough for them to provide support to the battle. Hotaling got on the net and requested pickup. Overloaded as they were, patrolling their way to the new location was out of the question. After some negotiation, one of two nearby CIA MI-17 helos was promised for the mission. The team packed up their gear and prepped for pickup. Shortly after 1800, Hotaling heard the CIA bird on a helo frequency. It was the same pilots from their insertion, and the unwieldy bird flew in ponderously, landing next to the team. They climbed up into the oil-streaked interior, passing their rucks inside. Unlike the Chinooks, the Russian helicopters had no ramps. Instead, equipment and men had to be hoisted up to the floor, 3.5 feet above the ground. When everyone had clambered aboard, the helicopter lifted off for the short hop to their new site. 4 minutes later, the team offloaded, and the lumbering helo disappeared into the sky. No sooner had it departed than it became clear they had been deposited in the wrong place. Not only were they not on their objective, they were no closer than they'd been before they were picked up. Trying to get the MI-17 back was futile. It was already on its next mission. The SAS was stranded on an alluvial plateau, the mouth of a dry stream bed emanating from between two peaks. Using GPS and their maps, the men determined their objective was up the water course. Walking the course without analysis or intel on enemy locations was asking to be ambushed. Recalls Hotaling, "After the CIA dumped us not where we needed to be and we'd mapped the course, it led straight up the creek. The terrain on both sides of the creek bed was masked. There was no way to know what was up there or between us and our OP. Plus, the distance was a motherfucker." They had no idea how long it was going to take to make the movement, but there was no doubt they were going to do it. Hotaling got on the net again, this time hoping for something that could serve as an ISR platform, at least a P-3. He contacted an orbiting AWACS, the best source for airspace coordination and requests, hoping for an AC-130. But all the gunships were prioritized in support of the actual fight taking place to their north. Instead, what appeared overhead was a Predator, an armed CIA drone, in this case, call sign Wildfire. "We're good," he informed Matt. The men shouldered their packs and stepped off into an uninviting darkness, their NVGs in place and weapons ready. It was going to be a long night. For Blaber, the long night had already stretched into an even longer day. When T.F. Hammer had gone bust, the Americans had returned to the safe house. On the battlefield, his teams were proving to be more of a decisive influence than the main force, who were taking it to the enemy in mortar duels and small arms engagements, but weren't destroying the majority of the targets and had suffered significant casualties. At TF-11, Brigadier General Trebone stated, "The good news was that TF-11 OPs performed their CAS function exceptionally well, inflicting 60% of the total enemy casualty count." At the heart of those words were a few combat controllers. Of the day's events, Blaber recalls, "Jay Hill is in the field with Juliet team, and he's creating kill boxes on the fly. It was just incredible. These guys, CCT, are some of the most well-rounded, all-purpose guys. If I was going to Mars on a mission, I'd definitely take one. It's a critical and serious decision to trade off a Delta shooter when mission space is tight. Not to be taken lightly, but, well, there you have it. I never go without one, and every one I've had was a stud." The damage AFO was inflicting was welcome news for the Delta officer. The doubters and obstacles were silenced or removed, and what remained was continuing to prosecute the mission to the fullest and ensuring he did everything he could to support and supply his men, who were hanging it out in the mountains. As if to emphasize the point, at TF-11, congratulatory messages and calls came in from Major General Hagenbeck and General Tommy Franks, the CENTCOM commander. President Bush and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld had seen Mako 3-1's Dishka photos before they were 12 hours old. Inside Tent City, Slab and Chapman caught the news as it unfolded, realizing that by holding out for a high-value target mission, they were missing the main show. During the run-up to Blaber's AFO missions and Anaconda's execution, they'd not actioned a single target. Inside the Gardez TOC, Blaber's satellite phone rang. He heard Brigadier General Trebone's familiar voice on the line. "Pete, wonderful job. Look, we can't ask you guys to continue this. You're not set for that. What I want to do is turn this over to the SEALs. Let them command it, and let them continue prosecuting the fight. You and AFO need to be out looking for the next battlefield. I want to send some SEALs down, and I want you to get these guys in there as quick as you can." Blaber was stunned. Nothing about Trebone's suggestion made sense. How the Air Force general officer and pilot would conclude there was an immediate need for more troops in the field was a mystery to him. He had little time to dwell on the subject, though, because all three teams were decisively engaged, and every minute of the 24-hour battle was critical, including Blaber's time. "Sir, my teams are fine for at least another 48 hours. I recommend that any team going into the valley goes through the same routine as the three teams already in the valley. Before they infiltrate, they need to spend time at Gardez so they can acclimate to the altitude and study the terrain and the history of the Shahi Kat. They need to talk to the CIA, the Special Forces, and the Afghan militiamen who have been working in the area." He searched his mind for anything else that might dissuade Trebone, landing on what he thought would settle the matter for any senior leader with troops in combat. "Sir, sending those teams in without any time to prepare for the environment doesn't make sense. It's setting them up for failure." The call ended without a definitive course of action. Blaber turned to his AFO intelligence officer, Glenn, who'd been with AFO from the beginning and had developed much of the plan that shaped the picture everyone in the safe house had come to rely on. AFO, CIA, and Special Forces alike. The Delta Intel veteran shook his head with concern, his eyes bloodshot from lack of sleep. I knew it. They have no idea how much preparation we put in to ensure those teams could operate in this environment. The two Delta officers locked eyes and then returned to their responsibilities. Something was going on at TF-11, but there was no time for solving that mystery. As he put on his headset and switched to the AFO SATCOM frequency, Blaber had no idea how right he was about his mission preparation time assessment. In less than 48 hours, others would pay a heavier cost in the absence of preparation. And for a few TF-11 men, the price would be the ultimate. Chapter 16. March 2nd. Midnight. The period of darkness, POD, on the night of March 2nd stretched on for everyone in the Shahikat Valley, including Al-Qaeda. From the enemy. We spent our night alert and on guard to deter any more airdrops throughout the night, as was expected. Before performing the morning Fajr prayer, we divided the brothers into three groups. The first joined the group of Malawi Saif ur-Rahman Mansur, for he needed more people. The second took position where the Shilka ZSU-23 anti-aircraft cannon was situated, at the entrance of the valley, which left myself, along with three other brothers, as support for any of the groups that needed more men. To begin with, we headed toward the location of the Shilka and took our positions in the rear to help curb the aerial bombardment, which had increased significantly. During the entire period, the enemy did not cease to spray the mountain peaks and valleys with the lava of bombs and missiles, while machine guns sprayed their bullets in every direction. The martyrs were too many to count. Many of the Afghans were now martyrs. One brother tried to hide in a trench from the bombs, but the trench was full to the top with dead Uzbeks. For combat controllers Jay Hill and Andy Martin, the POD was a non-stop airstrike fest, each controller sequencing aircraft, handing them back and forth, or sharing with TF Rakasan. The strikes were so frequent and numerous that the numbers and aircraft blurred. The devastation and relentlessness revealed in their after-action reports are impressive. Sometimes, the strikes were identified by the aircraft or munition. Other times, they describe merely the outcome. J. OP site and bunker, 2-3 KIA, AC-130. Andy. Enemy squad, 11 KIA, 5 WIA, 2x F-16s. J. Fighting position, 4 KIA, JDAMs, he reported over SATCOM. If anyone was on the ridgeline, they aren't now. Andy. Mortar position, unknown KIA, possibly 2-3, target suppressed, 4 GBU-31s. J. 3x fighting positions, 5 KIA, JDAM bomb box. Andy. Hilltop fighting position with possible mortars, unknown KIA, possibly 2-3, target suppressed, 4 GBU-31s, B-52. J. OP, 3 KIA, 2-5 probable KIA, JDAM bomb box. J again. Bunker, 3 KIA, JDAM bomb box. Andy. Congregation of enemy on ridge. Unknown KIA, possibly 2-3, 2 GBU-12s. J. Mortar position and 1x Dishka, 7 KIA, JDAM. Andy. Cave complex, 2 KIA, unknown damage to tunnels, 8 GBU-31s, B-1. J. Sniper position, 2 KIA, Predator Hellfire. Andy. Mortar position, unknown KIA, possibly 2-3, target suppressed, 4 GBU-31s. J. Mortar position, 2x Toyota pickup trucks, 4+ KIA, MK-82. And so it went. Through the entire night, without sleep, hands freezing on the mics and handsets, changing radio and rangefinder batteries as they drained in the below-freezing temperatures. They suffered blurred vision, and the pressure to ensure not only that each and every strike was on target, but that there was also no confusion with friendly locations, since the entire battlefield was anything but static as units and enemy positions maneuvered and fought. The two controllers weren't alone. Each was supported by his team. And though one mission was led by a SEAL, and the other a Delta operator, the leadership roles reversed once they were engaged, as Jay explains. A definite evolution, or change of mission responsibilities, take place after you first arrive. Before then, there's more of them, and they're taking care of certain things. Hey, this is our OP, this is where we're going. They're getting you there, they're defining the area. You're doing your own stuff and your position hasn't percolated to the top yet because you're not talking to aircraft. But as soon as it does, well, then you become the center point and you start tasking. I need you to do this for me. I want you to verify my coordinates. Hey, dude, I need you to check my math. Make sure, because I'm literally bombing people off of Falcon View and a laser rangefinder and they're three clicks away. The roles kind of get reversed. It's really complex. To get your eyes on target and come up with a game plan of how you're going to get aircraft in and safely separate them, drop bombs, and do it at night with the gear and the sensors we were dealing with at the time, and they were just not adequate. Back then, we had to correlate coordinates off Falcon View. If you say to a controller today, I was bombing off Falcon View, he'd just shake his head in wonder. It was terrible, but it worked. Because it had to. Each of the controllers ultimately had the responsibility for life and death. Life for the troops in contact and their respective teams, death for everyone else on the battlefield. The burden was heavy. Any slip when controlling such things as run-in bombing headings or restrictions or incorrect coordinates, even those that were read back by the pilot. And there was only one man who'd be the target of the subsequent investigation and left with a lifetime of guilt. One man left holding the bag. Conversely, if you were good, and sometimes lucky, you moved forward knowing your efforts made all the difference. As Jay and Andy traded aircraft throughout a night of blurred hours, Jim Hotaling only had access to a single platform, but it was all his, and its presence was critical. The CIA Predator shadowed and guided the SAS team as they worked to reposition themselves nearer the battle after the errant helo drop-off. The men progressed at an excruciatingly slow pace. To them, the Predator was a lifeline. Even though they were moving at night with NVGs, Al-Qaeda forces were everywhere throughout the valley, and its facing mountain slopes, exactly where they were traversing. Worse still, the terrain in every direction was higher ground, and they felt completely exposed. They had no place to maneuver along the creek bed, so an RPG or Dishka emplaced along their route would make short work of them. Even more alarming, the men staggered under the immense 140-pound loads they carried, making it impossible to identify threats from above. They were too busy trying to maintain momentum without falling over, and, like the AFO teams, stopping only led to freezing in the night, so it became a torturous tightrope balanced between exhaustion and cold. Between breaths, Hotaling periodically talked with the pilot, who was sitting in a heated box, most likely sipping coffee, mused the controller. But he remained grateful to have the Predator as our point man. When the drone approached Bingo Fuel, it would depart, replaced by another wildfire. On occasion, there were gaps in coverage, and Hotaling would fill the intervening time with the AWACS air coordination platform. Call sign Bossman, a poor substitute for men moving on the ground in rugged terrain, but still a source of continuity and comfort. When the next wildfire arrived, Bossman handed it off to Hotaling for control. His faith in the system wasn't misplaced, but Predator reliability was susceptible to overestimation. Visual acuity for the pilots scanning the ground below was no more than 2200, rendering certain angles and terrains a mystery, especially those with shadows. It's often noted that the operator's view was little better than staring through a straw from high altitude, so unless the focused lens passed directly over a threat, it was quite possible to miss the heavy machine gun or RPG position that could cost a life. Furthermore, as would happen repeatedly from the time of their introduction into the modern battlefield, Predators and other drones, even those with improved acuity, fed into another dangerous condition. For leaders sitting far removed from the battlefield, the temptation to believe that drone footage provided adequate situational awareness led to increased micro and mismanagement by general officers and higher headquarters. They felt their central operation centers, by virtue of information flow and video feed, somehow knew better than the men on the ground and their forward commanders. Combine that with the urge to do something when situations became dire, and it was inevitable for them to take control away and make decisions for the men on the ground. This would play out in Anaconda in tragic ways over the next 24 hours. For now, though, the Aussies progressed with the belief they were at least more secure than if there was nothing overhead, and it allowed them to double the speed at which they would otherwise have traveled, which was still a snail's pace. As the March 3rd sun rose in the east, they waited for its heat to clear the ridgeline so they could feel the warming rays of the fiery orb. When it finally reached the exhausted men, they stopped for something to eat and checked their location. After 12 hours of constant movement, they were only halfway to their new OP. The long night would now become an even longer and more dangerous day. At least the sun was shining on them from a clear but cold blue sky. As Hotaling shouldered his ruck, Pete Blaber was hitting his own wall. Awake for 55 hours straight, he pulled the headset off his matted, unwashed hair and dropped onto his cot inside the AFO tent for 2 hours of well-deserved blackout. When his alarm went off, he was still fuzzy. He grabbed his Glock pistol from under his pillow, tucking it into his tan cargo pants, and stumbled out into the morning with his toothbrush in his mouth to take a piss. In the tent next to him, Led Zeppelin's Kashmir was prophetically playing. Ablutions complete, he headed toward the TOC, passing a bunch of unfamiliar faces, only to be intercepted by Glenn, the Delta AFO officer, and Blaber's right-hand man in Bagram. Speaking rapidly, his agitated intel analyst told him two teams of SEALs had arrived earlier and their officer in charge was waiting for him in the TOC. Inside, Blaber found a Navy SEAL lieutenant commander named Vic and two teams of SEALs from SEAL Team 6's Red Team, Mako 30's Slab from the Recce element, and one other team made up of assaulters, not reconnaissance experts, call sign Mako 2-1. Led by a man named Al. "What are you doing here?" Blaber asked Vic, who explained that Trebon had ordered him to Gardez to command and control the SEALs, and that he was to infiltrate the teams into the ongoing fight that night. Blaber was instantly pissed. Grabbing a satellite phone, he stepped out of the TOC and into the compound for some privacy, leaving the SEALs behind, and rang up Trebon. "What's going on, sir?"
"Same thing I told you. I want these guys in the fight. Vic is in charge of the SEALs. You just stay in charge of the AFO guys. And when do you think you can turn them over to Blue?"
"Sir, there's no need to shove these guys into the fight. I don't need to put two more teams in tonight. We control the valley, not them."
Trebon cut him off.
"Pete, put both SEAL teams into the fight tonight. That's an order."
The general hung up. Blaber knew what was happening. With the sterile sounding and effective airstrike calls being reported across the AFO SATCOM net, it appeared to the TF-11 leaders that putting more teams and combat controllers in the field was simple. Stick them in a helicopter, fly them to some high ground, put the controller on the radio, make strikes. Easy. But in Blaber's mind, there was more to the situation. Trebon was an Air Force pilot and would never come up with the idea to push SEAL Team 6 into the fight. It could only be coming from Kernan and Szymanski. Glenn had been right. Neither the SEAL Team 6 leaders nor TF-11 generals understood conditions on the ground. And dropping men into the middle of the battle at the last moment without preparation was asking for disaster. The irony of Szymanski and Kernan pushing Trebon from below was not lost on Blaber, who'd had to convince the SEALs of the mission's value and had even off-ramped others for poor attitude and performance. Now, they didn't just want in, they wanted the entire show, and they had co-opted Trebon and Bagram to get it. When Blaber had asked Trebon in previous conversations whether the SEALs they intended to send down were going to conduct direct action missions, which were their forte, the general had replied their missions were to be the same as Blaber's current teams. The two had not settled on a time frame, so when Trebon asked about timing, Blaber replied, "I can't give you a time." The general wasn't satisfied. "I want you to come back to me with when the exact time is that you're transitioning this to blue." The one concession Blaber received was that Vic would serve as his number two until he turned over control. Vic was a contentious candidate to lead the SEALs in AFO operations. Technically, he was the Red Team recce officer in charge, placing him in the Navy chain of command between Slab, Goody, and now, by virtue of his inclusion in AFO, Al, the assaulter, and their senior officers, Szymanski and Kernan, back in Bagram. His few months in Afghanistan had been anything but quiet and had exposed poor judgment and leadership on two occasions. The first involved an unauthorized New Year's Eve vehicle movement between Bagram and Jalalabad, during which Vic and the SEALs in the SUV were stopped at a militia checkpoint. It resulted in shots being fired, injuring a SEAL, and necessitating the team's rescue by a British helicopter. The second of what became known as Vic's three strikes inside the TF-11 command occurred during a dry hole raid he led in which an unarmed Afghan had been killed when he approached the team's location. From the darkness of the SEAL's hiding spot, the civilian had been told in English to stop. When he didn't stop, the man was shot through the eye and killed. The SEAL, who shouted the English command and fired the round that killed him, was Vic. There was an investigation, but no charges, leaving an impression that extended up to the TF-11 commanding general, Del Daly. According to a TF-11 general officer familiar with both events, Vic got as much of a fair hand as any other person would, who ultimately showed probably not the right judgment. Defending Kernan's choice to continue allowing the junior SEAL officer to lead, he added, "You can't pick out a lousy judgment-type guy right off the bat." However, others were less forgiving, including SEALs within his own unit. When one Navy operator returned from the field to find Vic in the Gardez TOC that morning, he was stunned. "I got the feeling Vic was now running the show on the ground." Of course he was out of his league. But the decision to send Vic to run things and put teams in play was done. According to one official after-action report, Kernan had already made the decision to insert. For John Chapman, the drama surrounding who led the missions back at the rear in the Gardez safe house was immaterial. He had a new mission and set about prepping his gear, studying the AFO maps on the walls as well as talking with Glenn, the Delta Intel officer. He was joined by Ben Miller, the combat controller assigned to Al's Mako 2-1 team. While the two CCT had similar responsibilities, the nature of the separate team's composition and the fact that they came from different elements caused the two friends to implement their actions independent of each other and immerse themselves within the separate forces, just as Chappie and Andy had done previously during their early missions with Slab and Goody. A divide also existed between assault troops, with their direct action mission, and the more low-key snipers of recce. Slab, as the senior recce team leader, personified these differences with his introspective and laconic approach to dealing with others. As Slab and Chapman were making sense of their short-notice mission, the battle continued to rage at Mako 3-1's location, and another piece of the TF-11 SEAL puzzle fell into place. Between identifying and nailing down targets with his SEAL teammates and calling in airstrikes, Andy received an odd communication. It came from the TF Blue TOC in Bagram and didn't include anyone else in the AFO chain of command. Mako 3-1 had continued to provide their situation reports to TF Blue, the SEAL Team 6 element in Bagram. Of course, the two senior officers of the unit, Kernan and Szymanski, were also hearing Mako 3-1's transmissions on the AFO SATCOM channel. This message was different. TF Blue wanted Mako 3-1 to relocate to a new OP using one of the agency's MI-17s. That they would send the request directly to the team was new and odd, but it was where they wanted the team to relocate that got his attention. Taker Gar. Andy showed the message to Goody. The team's reply did not take long to formulate. Taker Gar was 3 kilometers away and had a commanding view of the valley, much better than their current location, but it had problems. Mako 3-1 responded with 3 points. 1. The team was perilously close to running out of ammo and batteries and would need resupply to execute. 2. With that in mind, they'd still need to go back to Gardez and then reinsert, but not on top of the mountain. They'd have to offset and walk their way up, which would take time. 3. Taker Gar was crawling with bad guys, as evidenced by the airstrikes and the inability of the 10th Mountain troops to occupy BP, blocking position Ginger, at its base. Goody turned them down with the push of the send button, which closed the matter for Mako 3-1. What was clear to Andy was, they, 6 as leaders, wanted us to insert on an MI-17 with a single door-mounted M60 machine gun. They wanted it done now. That mission would have required multiple DAPs and SEAL boat crews to take the summit. DAPs, direct action penetrators, were specifically modified MH-60s flown by the 160th SOAR. Essentially attack helicopters, they came equipped with variations of 50-caliber 7.62mm miniguns and 2.75-inch rockets. When we declined the mission, they moved it on to Slab's team instead. For the broader Operation Anaconda, things were not going smoothly. TF Rakasan was in fights, with strikes taking place everywhere in the valley. It was also taking a beating as Al-Qaeda forces continued to muster numbers and close with the army. With a handset to his ear, Jay watched from behind sunglasses and beneath his wool cap as yet another strike took out an Al-Qaeda bunker. This strike, from a B-52, delivered a 2,000-pound GBU-31, actual weight 2,036 pounds, and a monstrous 12 feet long. An airstrike has a strange and macabre beauty all its own. Massive ordnance detonations against ground targets produce the expected satisfaction of destroying your enemies in a vivid, billowing, black and orange ball of fire, smoke, and dust. At only 3 kilometers away, the initial violent explosion is followed by the reverberation as the radiating sound wave compresses air in every direction and reaches the ears a second later. As the sound fades, the black smoke billows upward and out, bits of rock, weapons, and human parts rain down in the immediate vicinity of the detonation. Finally, the last images of dust settling and spreading across the valley floor. It is mesmerizing to friend and foe. JDAM airbursts used on enemies in open terrain are different. These produce a string of black aerial cauliflower blossoms in a line, puffs of deadly 4th of July-type fireworks that, instead of celebrating a festive day, shred and mangle man and equipment below, without the dirt and flying debris. Jay and J-Team continued to prosecute the mission, though things were not going smoothly for them either, despite their superior fields of view and, by now, seamless teamwork. Like Mako 3-1, to ensure they weren't fragged by friendlies, the team did their best to mark themselves as American, but the task was made more difficult because the bad guys had VS-17 panels as well,
which we didn't know at the time, and they looked like us because they're wearing fatigue bottoms, North Face-type jackets, and civilian clothing, using Hilux trucks and whatnot. And many of them are Chechen and Uzbek or whatever, the point being they didn't look Arab or Afghan. So as far as on the mountaintop, we looked similar. And aircraft that were in the valley a lot, like the Apaches, might not know AFO was over here or there. Footnote. This actually happened to Jay and Delta during the insertion of the main 101st Forces earlier in the morning, when a flight of two AH-64 Apaches turned on J-Team's OP, lining up for a gun rocket run. Jay recalls all of them at the OP reflexively shouting, "No, no!" as he grabbed for the handset and radio, rapidly switching to 243 megahertz, the guard frequency, used by all aircraft for emergencies and always monitored during operations, and called them off at the last second, saving the team and preventing a tragedy. As Apache attack helicopters swooped across the valley, interspersed with fighter and bomber airstrikes, Jay was just beginning to work a flight of two F-15 Strike Eagles to hit a target on the whale, when Chris announced they had something in front of them. Jay and the Delta snipers watched through binoculars as an ancient white Toyota Land Cruiser pickup truck stuffed with enemy fighters rolled to a stop in front of the foothills below their OP. He recalls, "We're watching this guy, asking, what's he doing? He's looking right at us, and then jumps out and sets up a mortar tube and starts firing at us. We all went, fuck, as the first couple rounds were inbound. It was quick." Unfortunately for the Al-Qaeda mortar men, Jay's Strike Eagles hadn't committed to their brief target, and he rapidly lined them up with a new 9-line, diverting the flight to the enemy mortar position, now bracketing J-Team. With little time to spare and no pre-coordination, Combat Controller did it the old-fashioned way. He talked them onto the mortar position using years of expertise in guiding pilots to the target via descriptions of landmarks and features. Using only MK-82 500-pound dumb bombs, no laser or GPS guidance, Jay and the pilots shacked the truck, mortar tube, and its crew, killing a handful of Al-Qaeda. The jet fighters lived up to every bit of their name and reputation, leaving a shredded pickup and bits of human in their wake as the two Strike Eagles sped back to their base for fuel and more bombs. Chapter 17. March 3rd. Twilight. As the night of March 3rd approached, the men of Redback, the Australian call sign, a reference to the deadly native spider of the same name, were dragging themselves up the few remaining steps of the near cliff face to their OP. The final 300 meters of their movement exhausted the last of their physical reserves. Hotailing had reached his limits too. But as the rest of his team gratefully dropped their rucks and surveyed the immediate surroundings to determine the OP's defensibility and vulnerabilities, it was time for the combat controller to go to work. He placed his ruck near the top of a low saddle, opened it, and set about arraying his airstrike gear. He thanked Wildfire for the escort and then called several other entities, among them Bossman, the AWACS, Kmart, the Combined Forces Air Component Commander, who apportioned aircraft for use on the battlefield, and Tombstone, the TF Mountain Fire Support Center, before also dialing into the AFO SATCOM net. The question he really wanted answered was, what was going on in the other areas of the Shahi Kat? A great deal, as it turned out. At the Gardez safe house, Vic, the newly arrived SEAL officer, was in a difficult position. He wasn't the ideal selection to lead SEAL Team 6's aspirational AFO operations in Anaconda, but the situation and directives were not of his creation. They came directly from his SEAL leadership in Bagram, who believed they understood the conditions in the Shahi Kat better than those who had been boots on the ground for days, or even weeks. The truth was, Six had never prepared for the long duration and austere conditions under which AFO was operating. Delta's recce test missions had exposed this. Instead, SEAL leadership substituted prudent planning and preparation with a misplaced confidence in their men to overcome any obstacles without notice. In short, hubris. It wasn't that SEAL Team 6 operators weren't capable. Goody, Chris, and Eric were proving that, even as TF Blue worked to rush the new teams into the fray. But to rush, particularly the assault SEALs, with or without CCT, was to invite disaster. Blaber, the only officer on the scene with the knowledge and experience in the Shahikat to make such judgments, had made this clear. Going so far as pushing back against Major General Daly and Brigadier General Trebone to the point that he'd been told the generals were on the verge of firing him and removing him from country. But Vic lacked either the confidence or competence to fall in behind the ground truth understanding of Blaber and the teams in the field. I-Team, the All-Delta mission, had even weighed in on the subject via the AFO SATCOM frequency, stating, "It's unsafe, it's unsound, it makes no sense." So the Navy pressed ahead, even though Kernan hadn't originally pushed for such an early transition. In the AFO official after-action report, it's noted that, initially, Kernan proposed to Trebone that the shift from TF-AFO, as it was known, to Blue should take place over the next few days, with the TF Blue TOC assuming command and control on March 6th. What changed was the realization by TF Blue that the majority of the airstrike killing would be over by the end of the first week of March. Whether to avoid Blaber's pushback or for some other undisclosed reason, Vic and the SEAL Team 6 leadership in Bagram established a separate communications and chain of command structure for planning and implementing their missions. This meant two parallel command and control architectures would be in place, and Vic was the